Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll begin today with motorcycles, we will end with cars, and in between, well, yeah, pretty much the whole global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, June the 29th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There will be no beating around the bush to begin this program today. None at all. Just 5 minutes, maybe six, depending on how we're feeling, of what happened this week. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. David Gura anchors over at MSNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So it's probably going to be five and a half, actually. That's what they're doing, just so we all know. All right. So, Lee, I want to go to Monday. The news out of Wisconsin from Harley-Davidson. They're moving some production overseas in direct response to the president's tariffs. My question goes like this. Are you kidding? Nobody in the White House saw this coming?
Right. That's a good question. I mean, there's kind of like a law of physics here, like water finds its lowest point. I mean, trade will just readjust to find the most efficient route to the same outcome.
Yeah.
And so in Harley's case, I mean, they already have plants in other places, in Brazil and India and Australia and Thailand. So, they're going to try to do what they can to avoid these new tariffs, which in this case were imposed by Europe. But I think there's something else happening here, which is the global growth is no longer just here. I mean, that hasn't been the case for a long time. But, you know, Asia is a surging market for a company like Harley, newly affluent, et cetera. It's so much more efficient for a company to do the producing closer to the point of sale. And that's something that's sort of a parallel thing that's also happening and not going to stop at any time soon.
Right. It's all about the global supply chain. David, let me turn it domestically just a little bit, though. The president this week, after the Harley news, made very specific statements about Harley and how he's not pleased about it. And, you know, don't get cute on us is what he said. And yet, Harley workers, I don't know if you heard the interview on another public radio program whose initials are Morning Edition, with a Harley worker, a union shop steward, who said they still support the president, even though the president's policies have forced the company to do this, which threatens their job. Explain me that.
Yeah, there's this overriding sense among many Trump supporters that I've heard that the president must know what he's doing and what he's saying has to be right. And, you know, you talk about what we've heard from him since this announcement. There was that bizarre tweet where he sounded like a spurned lover saying essentially, look at all I've done for you and now this. But, you know, this is a serious tariff that's being levied on this company by the European Union. I think it's 31%. It was at 6% before that. So I think we're starting to see these real changes happening. What you're seeing backfiring here is the president's outreach or highlighting of these individual companies. We saw it again this week. He was up in Wisconsin at this new site for a Foxconn factory where he just made up numbers. He talked about there being 15,000 workers. Neither the company nor Wisconsin has said it would be that many. He says it's going to be a $15 billion factory. Again, neither the state nor the company has said it would be that much money as well. But again, he's highlighting these individual, what he wants to be success stories. When that's not happening, it's clearly deeply embarrassing for him.
Lee, from Axios this morning, report that the president is considering taking action on his long-held hard feelings against the World Trade Organization. In fact, trying to pull the United States out of the main regulating body for global trade. Play that out for me. What does that even look like, assuming he could do it?
I mean, it's incredibly disruptive. First of all, we don't know for sure that he could do it. I mean, by law, it's suggested that it needs to be an act of Congress. But that aside, I mean, this would be incredibly disruptive. The WTO sets and enforces the rules, manages disputes, but, you know, we only have free trade agreements with 20 countries. The rest of the world, you know, we'd be frozen out of 60%, not frozen out, but those countries could charge us whatever they want, and that could you know, just really, really disrupt our economy and the global economy.
I'm going to jump in here as well. There's been this debate, are we in a trade war or not? And a lot of people who have been reluctant to say that we are in a trade war say that because the United States is still playing by these global rules, that means that we're not there yet. Yes, there haven't been all these tariffs that have been implemented yet. But so far, what we've done is work within the confines, the constructs of the World Trade Organization. We've talked about bringing cases there. Just one other thing. I remember talking to Mike Froman, who was the former U.S. trade representative. And something he said was, you know, I think during the Obama administration, they brought dozens of cases to the WTO. And the success rate for the U.S. was extremely high. It's not like the U.S. has been losing case after case after case. So it seems like if this is true, it's a grievance that's pretty misplaced.
Yeah. So, Lee, let me actually just talk one more tariff story, because holy cow. It's worth a note here that on the 1st of July, the Canadian Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland, confirmed this morning that Canadian tariffs on American steel and aluminum go into effect. And then on Thursday next, the 6th, Chinese tariffs kicking in. And to David's point about us not maybe not being in a trade war, well, maybe then we will be.
No, absolutely. It just keeps, you know, getting worse and worse and worse. And there is a feeling that we're not even yet really in the fully downward spiral part of this. So it has a tremendous impact. And, you know, I mean, just going back to Harley, for example, the president took us out of TPP. Well, TPP would have reduced the tariffs that Harley would have faced in those countries to zero on their motorcycles. So it's just is left and right are just not making sense. I mean, it just feels like everything is opposite day, and just the logic is completely flawed at every turn. The president is being reactive. I mean, that's what this is. This is reactive and not really paying attention to facts and not wanting to be told that any of his ideas are a bad idea.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, David Gura at MSNBC. You can find him on the weekends. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, really strong most of the day. Energy kind of flagged at the bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so we're going to do a little bit more on the WTO here because global trade, am I right? Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin tried to push back this morning on that Axios report, calling it an exaggeration. The thing is, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports, the president is simply not right in his understanding of America's relationship with the main regulator, as I said, of global trade.
The rules governing global trade were set up by the U.S. and others in the wake of World War II. The WTO was formed in 1995 as a way to enforce those rules and settle disputes. Scott Miller is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The United States led that process all along, and frankly, we benefited magnificently from it.
There are now 164 WTO members. Together, they make up 95% of world trade. Member nations must treat each other equally. Miller says if the U.S. were to withdraw,
our trading partners could treat us any way they feel like.
The WTO allows trade disputes to be settled based on rules rather than power, says Edward Alden at the Council on Foreign Relations.
So if you look at the world like Trump does, that the most powerful country, the United States, should always get its way, then the WTO is kind of annoying because it empowers some of these smaller countries.
The White House's own data show the U.S. has won more than 85% of the cases it's brought to the WTO, compared to China's 67%. Julius Sen is at the London School of Economics.
It's rubbish to say the system was set up to screw the United States. No, the system was created by the United States to disseminate an idea of global free trade.
Sen says if the U.S. left the WTO, it would have to renegotiate 60% of its trade agreements, one by one. Still, he says, the trading system is in more danger if the U.S. remains but ignores the rules.
If a national government stays in the system but plays fast and loose with enforcement, then the system will break down.
Trump can't make this move alone. A U.S. withdrawal from the WTO would require an act of Congress. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of As California Goes, So Goes the Nation, now this item. We've got a brand new and really pretty sweeping data privacy law out here designed to give consumers more oomph in this digital economy in which we all live. Doesn't take effect until 2020, but when it does, Californians will be able to find out what data is being collected and why. They'll be able to ask to see who's brokering that data and to whom. And they can block data sharing or ask for their information to be deleted altogether. It comes, as you know, on the heels of the EU privacy law known as GDPR. So Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains what all that might mean to the big tech companies whose business models depend on personal data. Lots and lots of personal data.
Here's how the new law might work. Let's say a Californian visits an online store to buy some shoes.
You will see a link that says, "Do not sell my information."
Ashkan Sultani is a privacy consultant. He says once you click that link, the store can't sell your information.
For example, about what items you looked at, what items you might have put in your shopping cart.
This law gives Californians new control over their data, but makes it harder for companies, including Google and Facebook, to collect and use that data. Daniel Castro with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation says that'll hit companies where it hurts.
It makes it so they can't monetize user data the way they've been doing it in the past.
The problem, says Castro, is that a person can say to a company, "You can't use my data," but the company must still allow access to its service. Jessica Lee, an attorney at Loeb & Loeb, says many have already shored up some of their data practices, like Facebook letting users clear their histories. But she says companies will have to find new ways to get people to share their shopping habits and preferences.
Maybe you have what the newspapers have done. You have up to 5 or 10 free searches, and then after that you hit the paywall. You know, I think companies are going to have to get creative about how they make up any loss of revenue.
Another challenge for companies, how to mold their business around one law in one state. Lee doubts businesses want to offer protections for Californians, but not everybody else. That's why she could see this law becoming the de facto standard nationwide. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
One more quick thing before we move on here. A new thing we're doing. Me and Molly Wood, a riff on our podcast, which I believe I've mentioned before on this program, is called Make Me Smart. If you've got an Alexa, Amazon Echo, yes, technically, all you got to do is say, "Alexa, make me smart." And we will deliver up an explainer about the economy or tech or pop culture, a new one every weekday. And remember, you can always say "Play Marketplace" from any smart speaker you got. Coming up,
what followed was a rich epic of corruption and failure.
Why, in an economic sense, it is so very hard to get a cab sometimes in New York City. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on a Friday. Dow up 55 points today, 0.2%, closed to 24,271. As I said, up a bunch more earlier in the session. The NASDAQ up 6 points, basically unchanged, 7,510. The S&P 500, 2 points to the good, less than 0.1%, or perhaps unchanged, I could have said, 2,718. For the week, the Dow off 1.25%, NASDAQ down 2.3%, S&P 500 down 1.33%. We mentioned that new data privacy law in California. It looked then at some of the companies affected by that. Facebook slipped 0.9%, Google's parent company Alphabet up 0.2%. In the financial sector today, Federal Reserve gave some of the big banks the okay to buy stock and raise dividends after their stress test results came back okay. Wells Fargo deposited 3.3%. Citigroup stayed about the same, basically flat. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace delivers independent public service journalism that matters. You can help us do it by becoming a Marketplace investor today. And right now, your donation in any amount could unlock a $25,000 challenge from Candida if we meet our fiscal year goal of 6,000 donors by June the 30th. So please contribute today at marketplace.org. And thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There have been a zillion stories written and broadcast about the collapse of the American housing market. We have done our share for sure. Usually, though, there's stories of foreclosure and people losing their homes or what happens to neighborhoods and cities when real estate dries up. Today, something a little different. As part of our series about the financial crisis and the recession that followed, a series we're calling Divided Decade. The collapse of the housing market forced millions of people to reconfigure their economic lives. They lost their houses and their jobs. Millions more rode out the recession just by cutting back, living with less. We are going to take a closer look at what happened inside people's houses and what a decade after the economy basically broke, what we think about when we think about home. Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
Jan Ashford is going through a bit of an awkward phase with her parents. Every now and then, her dad, who's trying to downsize, calls her to offer up his old furniture, as if she's won the lottery.
I'm like, Dad, really? No, we don't want it. But what about this painting? Dad, really, I don't need the gilded frame.
Or the brass bed, or that old oak chest from Ethan Allen.
He thinks of it as like an investment because he knows what he paid for it in 1985. And it's not an investment anymore.
Even if it were, Ashford, who's 34 and works in sales, would not be interested. She's done the formal dining room, fancy dishes, and showy art. But she unloaded all that during the Great Recession, when she and her husband were forced to move around a lot for work. Now she wants furniture that's light, easy, and inexpensive. She says what matters is that her home feels homey.
We don't purchase art anymore. We make art, and we get our kids involved. And it's cheaper, it looks cool, and it's more representative of us.
Cheaper, cooler, simpler. That shift is more representative of a lot of people who were all about their homes before the recession, then scaled back and learned to live smaller. You can see that shift in color, too. Erica Wolfel is vice president of color and creative services at Bear Paint and part of the team behind names like Flirt Alert and Fuzzy Duckling.
Yeah, we are those people, the color namers.
Wolfel says before the housing bubble burst, people were sinking all kinds of money into remodeling and covering their walls with bold colors like circus red and laser lemon. Then,
in about 2008, 2009, we started to see the rise of the color gray. People might be preparing to sell a house. So they're looking at these very safe, kind of conservative colors that were easy to decorate around.
And what was safe slowly became style. People love their grays.
It's a macro trend that's really lasted the past 10 years.
To keep up, Wolfel says Bear added 70 new shades of gray in the last 2 years alone. You could say that gray found the upside of the downturn. You could say that this company did too.
My name is Lars Peterson, and I'm president and CEO of IKEA US.
IKEA, famous for meatballs, the $100 Poing chair, and the classic $10 LAC table, which at this point I could put together in my sleep. During the early 2000s, the Swedish company was making a big push into the U.S., investing in larger stores and more cities. When the economy went south and the home furnishings industry hit the skids,
we could say that our original concept was even stronger when people have a tough time.
IKEA doesn't break out sales by country, but Peterson says during the early years of the financial crisis, store traffic slowed down briefly, but that IKEA didn't take nearly the hit that the rest of the industry did.
I think it was really clear that people didn't want to spend extra money just with a label on a product.
Peterson says one legacy of the recession is that doing things became more important than buying things, especially among millennials.
It's very much about experiences.
On a recent trip to IKEA in Burbank, California, I met two young women who, let's just say, were creating their own experience.
We've been on this couch for over an hour watching a high-speed chase on TV.
Adriana Perez and Susie Hyam have no plans to buy anything today. They're literally camped out in an IKEA model living room with their feet up. They both work in marketing nearby, and they're on their lunch break.
It's Monday. That's how you start off the week.
For Chaim, hanging out here isn't much different than what she does at her own house, which is full of IKEA stuff she got on Craigslist, including her couch, which, in the scheme of things, is not nearly as important to her than the pillow that's on it.
It says Pura Vida,
Spanish for pure life.
And I got it from Costa Rica.
She got it on a trip there last year, the trip where her boyfriend proposed to her. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Uber caught a big break earlier this week. The City of London, England, gave the company a short-term operating license contingent on good corporate behavior, basically. It resolves, for now, the fight between Uber and London's black cabs. In New York City, meanwhile, uneasy still lies the relationship between Uber and Lyft and yellow cabs. We've done some reporting on that. Cab owners, medallion owners they're called, for the metal badges literally riveted onto a cab's hood physically, they are not happy, suffice it to say. We saw a tweet storm the other day that lays out the economics of this thing pretty well. Barry Ritholtz is a columnist at Bloomberg. He runs Ritholtz Wealth Management as well, and he tweets at Ritholtz. So here it is. Tweet number one.
This is an Uber, Taxi and Limousine Commission, or TLC as they're known, medallion owner tweet storm.
Tweet two.
In 2016, in Manhattan's core, Uber picked up 3.8 million new riders, while yellow taxis lost 3.8 million rides.
Tweet number three.
For those of you who are not New Yorkers, here's a little bit of history. The Taxi and Limousine Commission was created in 1971.
Tweet four.
What followed was a rich epic of corruption and failure. Inspectors from the TLC demanded bribes. They engaged in shakedowns and extortion.
Tweet five.
The fleet owners were no better. They rigged taxi meters. They scabbed their own drivers. But when they were not busy with these illegalities, they were working hand in glove with the TLC to restrict the number of medallions. How few medallions were there in New York City? A stunningly low amount.
Tweet six.
The medallion count in New York City has been restricted ever since the 1930s, when there were only 16,900 licenses issued to cabs.
Tweet number seven.
Astonishingly, today, there are even fewer. There are only 13,587 medallions.
Huh. Tweet number eight.
Just stop for a moment and consider that. The number of vehicles where you can just walk to the street and wave your arm is less today than it was 80 years ago, when the population was more than a million fewer people in New York City.
Wow. Tweet number nine.
So the TLC and the medallion owners created an artificial monopoly. They are the ones who created the market opportunity for firms like Uber and Lyft. Monopolies lead to terrible economic behaviors. Hold aside the meter tampering for a moment and consider the legal levels of terrible service in New York City today for taxis.
Tweet 10.
Drivers change shifts at 5 or 6 o'clock, abandoning the city in the midst of rush hour. They flee to the outer boroughs or the west side or even New Jersey for driver changes.
Tweet 11.
Heaven forbid a single drop of rain falls in New York and it's impossible to find a cab. And the cars themselves are frequently in terrible shape.
Tweet number 12.
Enter ride-hailing apps like Uber and Lyft.
13.
Last year was the first time more people were using Uber in New York than the city's fabled yellow cabs.
Tweet 14.
The Daily, the New York Times podcast, had this really fascinating conversation with a yellow cab driver who had purchased a medallion. He described how hard being a driver had become. It's not just the big fleets that own all the medallions. Many drivers had bought their own, and now they are hurting.
Tweet number 15.
These drivers are now deeply indebted, having purchased medallions with loans at the top of the market. Since they made these buys, the medallions have plummeted in price. In 2010, they went for a little over $600,000. They escalated each year, peaking in June 2013 at $1.3 million. Then the slide began, and by June 2017, they were under $250,000.
Wow. Tweet 16.
There are lots of bad players involved in this. The Taxi and Limousine Commission, medallion owners, and of course, Uber's bad behavior is legendary. The car drivers, both for Uber and the yellow cabs, they've become collateral damage in this battle.
Tweet number 17.
But the fundamental underlying issue has been the TLC thwarting market forces by constraining the supply of cars and limiting competition.
Tweet number 18.
Technology has stepped into this void. The transition periods when technology comes along are always painful.
Barry Ritholtz, you can find him on Twitter at Ritholtz. You can get me at Kai Ryssdal. The shop is at Marketplace. I think we're onto something, by the way, with audio Twitter threads on economics. We did one a while back on how Jay Powell wound up at the Fed, which you might want to listen to. If you see a good one you think we ought to know about, send it on by. This final note on the way out today, delivering on the promise to start with motorcycles and end with cars. As you might have heard, President Trump has been threatening in that way he has to hit foreign car makers with tariffs. Just because there is bureaucracy in almost everything governmental, part of the process of making those tariffs happen is allowing public comment on the prospect of the tariffs. General Motors weighed in today, and I'm just going to read part of what they submitted. Quote, increased import tariffs, the biggest car maker in the country wrote, could lead to a smaller GM, a reduced presence at home and abroad for this iconic American company, and risk less, not more, U.S. jobs. End of quote. That's from GM on tariffs. All right, we're going. The Dow Industrial's up 55 points today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ up 6, basically unchanged. S&P 500, 2 to the good, unchanged as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.